this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Hey, here's a question for you. What would you say to your younger self, someone 10, 20, or 30 years back in time? Well, I asked that difficult question to my mentor, Mark Ford, after he had spent 3 decades dedicating himself to getting rich, learning languages, becoming a poet and artist, and building a billion-dollar business. Now, Mark's answer is very vulnerable, and it's going to change how you look at your life, your work, and even how you set your goals. This could really be the best interview I've ever done, and maybe I ever do in my career. I could really retire after this one. Because before there was Tim Ferriss, there was Mark Ford, the real-life world's most interesting man. And that's why this episode of Early to Rise Radio is a must-listen. I'm your host, Craig Valentine, and I want to invite you to grab a drink, sit back, and join me and the founder of Early to Rise, Mark Ford, in his cigar bar in Delray Beach, Florida. That's where we had this epic discussion, covering his journey from being a broke, misbehaving kid on Long Island to the first time that he retired at age 39, and then his second retirement, and then his third act as a business mentor and best-selling author. Everything you need to know about life is in today's show. All right, Mark. So really excited to be here with you today and have this conversation. So thank you.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Very good. Very good. So let's start from the start. And you grew up really with nothing, on the wrong side of the street, on the wrong side of the tracks. Or did you say that you grew up on the middle of the tracks or something like that?
I was a poor transgender Filipino with two abusive parents.
And that's it? Just two?
Just two. And we were 8 children. And our parents in a house that was about 900 square feet.
In Long Island?
On Long Island. Yeah. Well, first I was born in Brooklyn, but when I was 6, we moved out onto the island, and we were in this this crummy little house, and there were four of us in one room. And it was, you know, it was a house that I was embarrassed to represent as my own. So I had all of that. We grew up drinking powdered milk, and our main food supply was these two large vats, one of peanut butter and the other of jelly. And you can make yourself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich by putting a spoon in either one of them. There was so much intermixing going on. You could also get extra protein because there were numerous flies embedded in them. And so, but it was also a family that was very rich, culturally, intellectually. My parents were smart parents, and that had a culture of learning and reading and so on. And so,
lots of books in the house.
The house was just
made of books.
I mean, literally our dining room table was held up by books. One of the legs went out, and it was propped up by books, and it stayed that way for about 17 years until I left. Those are books that apparently either had been read or were not on anybody's reading list. But
where did you fall in the?
I was number two.
Okay.
My sister Denise was the eldest, and she was the one that had to also be, while my mother was working, she had to play the role of the substitute mother for us. And she was pretty tough. I remember very distinctly the day that she started hitting me, and I realized that she couldn't hurt me. And it was, I just remember this smile that came over my face, and my chest puffed out.
How old were you?
I don't know. I must have been about, I would like to say I was younger, like 11, but she's pretty big and strong, so I was probably more like 14 by the time I was big enough to withstand her her physical intimidations. So I was the second, and I was kind of the bad boy of the family. I was the one that was always getting in trouble, and I was a very good student until about fourth grade. Fifth grade was my transitional year, and beginning at sixth grade, I was an enfant terrible, and I kind of got, I don't know whether I got kicked out or...
Of grade six?
grammar school, yeah.
Wow.
But this was a Catholic school with nuns. After I survived all their various tortures, which were, all of which would have been illegal today. numerous batterings and beatings and rubbing of gum into the hair so you had to get your head shaven. And these women were strong. I mean, one of them, I remember I was in eighth grade and she lifted me up against the wall with one hand, started banging my head up against the wall. I was very impressed. Her name was something like, usually it was like, Anne Joseph or, Marie Rocky, there's always one male and one female name. It was a chaotic house, lots of crazy kids around. I was just a troublemaker. I renounced my Catholicism when I was like 14 or 15.
And then you started going to a regular high school?
No, this was afterwards. I was asked to leave after I was caught urinating in the biology sink.
Okay.
And that was the day after I got caught mooning the music teacher from fifth row. So I was kind of looking for an escape, and they gave it to me. And so then I went to public school, and I didn't do much better there. I know I passed the first year of my... By the second year, teachers knew who I was, and I spent my entire year in Spanish under Mr. Ringbold, standing up in front of my desk with my hands held high above my head, and I had to maintain that posture for the entire semester.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
can't get away with that now.
He had my number, I think it was. I give him credit because it was very difficult for me to disrupt the class standing that way. I didn't learn much Spanish, but so I was kind of a troublesome child. But our family was very, as I said, they were very academic, and there was I was writing poetry and stories from when I was 9 years old, I did play the French horn as a child, and there was plenty of opportunities for intellectual growth in my family.
What was your money mindset in back in the days like, and how did that evolve through your family,
right?
That what did they passed on to you until you were had that pool business in your late teens, early 20s?
Right. Well, my parents didn't know anything about money, and they didn't care anything about money, and nobody else in my family did either. The only mindset I can remember having is I was very embarrassed about how shabby our house was and how, we wore hand-me-down clothes. Mm-hmm. We would go to these functions at Christmas, and people would break out the boxes of clothes, and then that was what I wore to school, and it always embarrassed me, although one year I did manage to get the clothes of a guy whose name I still remember. His name was Bruce Conger, and he was a great older than me, and he was very, very cool, and he always had the coolest outfits. And so I remember instantly when I opened up the box, I knew it was his clothes because I so much admired him. Those tight olive green pants, the tapered to the ankle, and the bright kind of purple shirts, all of which somehow managed to pass within the regulatory uniform of at school. The shoes, we used to call them very politically incorrect Puerto Rican fence climbers. They were the shoes that had were pointed in the front, so that if you had to climb over a galvanized fence, your feet would fit very neatly into those things. You could get up and over very quickly. And anyway, that was my my early experience with money, was being embarrassed about being poor. And then I remember later on, I was thinking about this the other day, I used to, when I got older, I would try to coach my parents into, saving money, and why did they spend so much money on booze and cigarettes and so on. Of course, now I understand why they did.
Right.
Money well spent. But back then, I had this like desire to like, to improve our lot by good basic financial management skills. But there was no tutoring about building wealth. There was nothing about work ethic. My parents worked nonstop, so we were expected to work nonstop, and we did. We worked. We all had chores that we did every single day, and on weekends. We couldn't go out on weekends until we had memorized poems. That was one of the rules. On weekend days, we had to spend the mornings memorizing a poem, and then once it was memorized, then we could go out and play. And so It was a combination of, I would say, humility, embarrassment, deprivation, and also cultural enrichment. So it was overall a very good childhood.
What lessons did you take away from your father, whether he taught you directly or you absorbed indirectly just through his behavior, like you said, that he just worked really hard?
Well, I used to say that this is true of all families. I don't know if it's true, but it's true of my family. I would say that our father's role was in teaching us kind of moral standards and integrity, like how to be, what is required of being a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was all about working hard and, being honest and being principled and standing up for what you believed. My mother...
Well, quick question there. So did your father look at people who had money in a bad way, or did he just not care?
He didn't care.
Got it.
He didn't even notice. I remember when my mother bought a new lamp, he had a desk that a chair he sat at in the living room, and there was a little side table, and there was a lamp, and it was always on when he came home and stayed on. I guess I don't know why that was, but I remember when she got it, she told us, let's see, don't tell your father that this is a new lamp, and let's see how long it will take him. Well, days passed and then weeks passed, and it was at least a year or two later where he turned and looked at the lamp and says, Joan, is this a new lamp? I was happy enough to be there that day. He just wasn't, he was like the Chaucer's Scrivener, I guess. Was it the Scrivener that he just was not, he was interested in, things of the mind, and he didn't care, he didn't notice, he wasn't jealous of it. It just wasn't, and when I started making money, becoming wealthy, he didn't give a hoot about that either. It didn't mean anything to him. And it frustrated me a little bit. My mom was already dead by then, but she loved, theater and the arts and so on, but she also loved beauty and she loved beautiful things. And she certainly would have loved to be in a beautiful house I realized after she died, and then after I got wealthy, she had already been dead for some number of years, that I had this very hollow feeling about this disappointment about becoming wealthy. And then I realized that it was because I had this secret plan to impress my mom with it and to be able to buy things for her that she'd appreciate. And all I had my dad who didn't notice and didn't care at all. I mean, I could say, look at this new sports car I buy, and he would go, looks a little small. Comfortable in that thing, you know, or whatever, you know. And
so, did you get your love of art from your mom? Do you think?
Yeah, my definitely from my mom. She really was the. Although my father was in the education and the arts, she was the one that I think instilled in the family a love of art, a love of all things cultural. And, you know, of the eight children, four of us, all four of the women ended up in theater.
Oh.
And of the boys, my father was a teacher. One of my brothers was a teacher, and then I was a teacher for a while, and then my other two brothers were not. They eventually went into business.
So did you have any family big dinners or get-togethers like every week or something that, you know?
We had dinner every night.
Yep.
And every night my father would read to us from Shakespeare or the Bible or what have you. The Bible was considered a book of literature. My father was really an atheist, but he pretended, you know, my mother was religious, so, mm-hmm. you know.
He went along?
He went along, and he would read to us while we were, again, we weren't allowed to eat until we finished reading. Most of that time was spent with whatever food that we didn't want to eat, whether it was a peas or anything that was green. That entire reading time was spent with us taking it discreetly off our plates and throwing it under the chair of one of our siblings.
Right.
Which turned out to be a very good strategy because by the time the meal was started, my mother would never eat with us. She would always sit in the next room having a cocktail, listening to Mozart blasting so she didn't have to even deal with us. I mean, she gave birth to us and she had to, you know, it raised us when we were younger, so she had enough of us by then. So my father was trying to civilize us. But the great thing is if somebody came in and noticed that we hadn't even begun eating and none of the spinach was left and it was all under everybody's chairs, we could honestly look down under our own chairs and say, I swear that's not me. I didn't do that because we had thrown it under the other's chair.
You had a nice plan, huh?
It just came natural. I think just a natural survival intelligence of all of us.
So then you soon started a pool business. Was that your first business? And how old were you when you did that?
No. My first business was, I was working almost nonstop when I was 9 or 10. I was 11 when I first published my first book, Excuses for the Amateur. I did it on a Xerox machine or something. And I sold it for 50 cents a piece, I think it was, to all my classmates. These were, maybe it was less than that. 50 cents seems like it was too much. Anyway, I sold it. Excuse about, you know, why you don't have your homework, why you came in late, why this and that. And I actually made some money. And I also got hauled into the principal's office. So it was an early omen of my entire writing career. You
know? Well, I know we don't have a copy of that one at Early to Rise.
We don't. It's
not in the files. Copy, right?
I could probably drum up some of those excuses if I needed to. But yeah, that was, and I worked, I was a paper boy. I worked at, when I was 12, I was working in the local car wash on weekends and on evenings. And that was tough work. Jumping in, my job was to wipe off the back seat and the windows in the back of the car.
Uh-huh.
So you would jump in, wipe them all down, and you jump out and you jump into the other car.
Huh.
And every so often I would look at the clock and like 40 seconds had passed.
Right.
And I had done like three cars and that was pretty miserable. So I was working either figuring out my own jobs. I used to go over to the neighbor's house and clean their yards or clean their house and charge money for it. I was always looking to make money because I, even at a very young age, I had this, I was ashamed of my own clothes, so I wanted to buy clothes. And I remember when I was 11 or 12, I bought a pair of shoes that cost $30 at the time, which would easily be $300 today or more. And I remember them exactly. And I got it from all these various odd jobs I did. So, yeah, I was, the pool business was much later. That was.
Were you the only sibling among your group that was doing that? Like, or that looked at money that way?
And is, no, that's a good question. I mean.
And where did that come from?
I don't know. I think that my, I'm pretty sure my, none of my sisters were doing it. And my brother Andrew was not doing that. He was very academically inclined. He was, you know, we had plenty of work to do around the house, but he spent his time in, as a scholar. He became a scholar. He's a scholar now. But my sisters, I think not, and my two other brothers were 10 years younger than me.
Oh,
and so
okay.
They were kind of in a different world. I hardly, you know, I mean, my entire use for them was to, I would teach them Hamlet's soliloquy or the introductory pages of the Communist Manifesto and make them memorize them. Then when we had beer parties in my basement, unbeknownst to my parents upstairs, that's how chaotic the house was, I would have them recite to my friends. This is when I was in high school. I would bring them down and they would, you know, recite. And my friends would, you know, think that was great fun. You know. So I don't know. I don't know if any, but certainly those two younger brothers eventually became interested in business and now are both entrepreneurs.
So you started the pool business when you were how old?
Let's see.
Did you go to college?
I went to college.
Okay.
I went, I had poor grades in high school and I went to community college, an Essex community college. But I was a very good student there and I got basically straight A's and good recommendations. And then I went to Queens College, which is part of City University of New York, because of the low tuition. And I was a very good student. And during that period of time, I worked full time. I worked, you know, days and nights earning money because I was out of the house. I had left the house before I was even finished high school. Okay. I was living on my own.
What was your tuition? Do you remember?
It was, I think, $400 a semester.
Okay.
Yeah. National Community College. And so I did every possible job you can imagine. I was working in warehouses. I was painting houses with my friend Peter. I was doing carpentry. But then I got a job one summer working for a guy building above ground pools. And I realized that I must have been a freshman or something in college. And I realized that this was a business opportunity. So with two friends of mine, we started such a business of our own. And it became, you know, very successful. We were earning, I think I was earning like between $300 and $500 a day.
Wow.
And, you know, back then it was almost like we were cocaine dealers. And we worked the entire 10 weeks of the summer without a day off. So I never was spending any money and the money was just piling up. And then we had crews working for us as well. So actually, as it turned out, my friend Peter continued. That became his career. It was a business and he did it for 20 years. But then I left after I had some dispute with the other partner that, I had to take a little time off because I was in college. I had to do something. I couldn't work quite as many hours and we had a big argument about it. So I just quit. And then that was the end of that. But that was I think that was the first time I made like more money than I could spend.
Okay. So that was early 20s. And then to fast forward through a few things, you went and you volunteered in the Peace Corps, you went to Africa, you got married in there, and then you came back and then you decided to get rich, right?
That's right. That's right. Basically, that's right.
So you decided to get rich at a Dale Carnegie course and,
yes.
And talk about, you know, what you did as soon as you made that, why you made that decision and then what you did.
Well, the course was a course on how to win friends and influence people. I thought I was taking a course on public speaking because I had gotten a job with a publisher in South Florida. I was an editor in chief and I didn't know much about editing. But I was invited to speak at some kind of national conference of editors. I have no idea why they invited me, but they did. Must have been a mistake. So I took this course to try to prepare myself. Turned out I took the wrong course. It was the 14-week course on how to, you know, make yourself over as a person. But it was a very good course. And one of the lessons was about setting goals. I remember Carnegie said that for most people, the problem is they're unwilling to set goals. They find a million excuses about why they could or they shouldn't set. And we find this every time New Year's rolls around. There's 1,000 articles out there about why New Year's resolutions are stupid. And these are all people that have not been successful and don't understand the value of setting goals. Or they do understand it, but they want to sound clever. So they say, they use a different term than setting goals. They say, I'm setting objectives. Or they say, I don't do it on New Year's. I do it on another day. Or it's all kind of silly stuff. But I remember he said that some people set too many goals, and their problem in terms of achievement is they want to do so many things that there's all these conflicts, and so they can't. Step one was to identify your goals. Step two, narrow them to 10. Step three, narrow them to 3, and then finally narrow them to 1. And then that was the goal you were going to present in front of the class. The way this program works is once a week you got in front of your little group and you would make a little speech. And that speech was about what I was going to do for the rest of the 14 weeks in terms of my main goal. And my main 3 goals were teaching, you know, becoming a great teacher, becoming a writer, professional writer, and becoming rich. I was torn. It was very hard to choose between one or the other because I felt like if I chose one, I was giving up the other. And at the last moment, I walked up to the podium and I had this thought, just get rich first. And then, you know, if you're rich, then you can have time and money to become a writer or to become a teacher in your retirement. And so that's what I said. I made that announcement. And then I took seriously the challenge of making that my primary motivation, thought, sense of awareness for the coming 14 weeks, and it completely changed my life. I mean, the next day when I went in, I was working as the editorial director of this up-and-coming publishing business, and I was spending all my time coming up with, new rules of, you know, protocols for style and grammar and writing memos to writers about how to be more clever writers and this and that. At the moment I walked in the next day, I just took all those books and all that information. I'd like to say I dropped them in the garbage. I don't think I did, but I put them aside.
And you used them to prop up a table or something.
Probably, yeah. I never paid attention to them again. And I realized, like, it was so funny. Overnight, I knew what business I was in. I was in the business of selling subscriptions to these publications, these newsletters on agribusiness and robotics, these kind of. But I realized that the business that we were in was not making sure that people that were reading about robotics were not offended by, you know, too many past participles.
Or the Oxford comma, which I don't even know what it is, but it's a big deal, I think.
Where the Oxford rule, that was a big, we could spend endless fun hours talking about that, but we won't bother your readers with that. So I just recognized that we were in a different business, and so it just changed me instantly. Everything became easier to understand. Decisions were easier. Associations were easier to understand. Who I should be talking to, who I shouldn't. What kind of conversations were useful to me? What kind were useless or destructive? And it became so clear. I mean, once you decide that your goal, your primary goal is to make money, it's very easy. Mm-hmm. It's not complicated at all. Everything becomes easy. The problem is most of us don't do that, and for good reason. There are many other things. We naturally understand that there are many more important things in the world than becoming wealthy, financially wealthy. But on the other hand, when you're poor, you still have a responsibility of taking care of yourself and about paying your way through life. And And if you don't accept that responsibility, then your life is, you know, completely at the mercy of institutions that you hope will take care of you. But if you accept the fact that you're responsible for yourself and you make that decision, it's enormously, if you have, I would say, reasonable to slightly above average intelligence, if I could put myself in that category, things become just so much easier.
Well, I will tell you one thing, not about the money thing, but about the goal setting thing that I remember way back. It was, and I can remember the day, it was 2006, and I had just set my goals. It was New Year's Eve. I was going to a wedding, and I had a full page of goals in 10-point font. And then I don't know if it was the next year or within a couple of years, either I read an article or maybe I read one of your books where it said, you're setting too many goals. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's me, because I would set them all right. And I would be disappointed at right. the end of the year because right. I had right. achieved some of the minor
right.
ones.
Right.
And then when it was narrowed down, I think what you said in one of your articles was one goal for your health, wealth, social self, and personal
right.
enrichment.
Right.
And when I did that, everything became much right. simpler. Right. And going back to what you said about, well, if I get rich, then I can become a teacher later on. You achieved those other goals by becoming rich, right?
Right, exactly. And in fact, the thing that you read about one out of four, that came later.
Okay.
The first decision was to focus only on wealth, because that was what Dale Carnegie said. That's what our instructor said we had to do. And in 14 weeks, it completely changed me. What I'm saying, Craig, is I think very few people did well. Very few people who are naturally complex are likely to make this decision, because it just goes against your grain. And I think that you may tell yourself you're going to focus on one goal, but when you have 15 other secondary goals, you're not really doing it. The way it worked for me was that I had to say to myself, in focusing on this one goal, I'm willing to give up all those other goals. In other words, I was willing to, at the time, not even think about becoming a writer. I told myself I'd do it later, but I knew that was kind of, you know, a rationale, and certainly was on a day-to-day basis. I wasn't going to pay attention to my goal of teaching. More than that, I wasn't going to pay attention to what should have been my goal of being a good father, a good husband, a kind employer, what have you. All those things I didn't give a shit about. I didn't care what employees thought about me.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what they had to do. And if they weren't going to do it, I was going to fire them. I was going to yell at them. I was going to cajole them. I was going to do anything I needed to do to get the money made. And that's really what changed me. I mean, it changed me very deeply and almost permanently. The article you're referring to, I wrote considerably later, more than 10 years later, after I had already become wealthy and realized that I had narrowly escaped, you know, destroying my family life, losing my spouse, you know, all kinds of friendships that I barely maintained. I mean, the truth was I never wanted to give those things up. Since I had the singular focus and I felt like I had to be true to it, I always told myself, well, if you lose it, you lose it. If you lose that friendship, so be it. And my partner at the time happened to be naturally that way.
Mm.
He was just a natural moneymaker. And so I also learned a lot from him about how to do that smartly instead of bluntly. But later on, I decided that I didn't want to keep telling people to do that, because you can end up turning yourself into, you know, a monster. And of course, we all find out that these things are not important anyway.
Right.
Having, you know, becoming, you know, what does it even mean to be wealthy? You know,
would your father say that he was wealthy?
No, my father wouldn't even, I swear, he wouldn't even. Whole idea, he would kind of look at you oddly and then he'd go back into another conversation, you know. It just never, it has no interest. Actually, it's funny, one of my brothers whose goal now is to become richer than I am, he will do it. He's in the real estate business and he's done phenomenally well. He started in 2009 after the crash, and in the 9 years that have passed since then, he's acquired a very large net worth, and he's doing tremendously. But he's actually like my father. He has no interest in material things. He's living in a house still in a African-American neighborhood in Delray Beach that's somewhat dangerous and probably worth $170,000. He could be in a multi-million-dollar house. And it's not because he's trying a social experiment. He just thinks it's fine. He doesn't understand. You know, his neighbors are nice. Everything. He's a little Warren. He's like the
it's
real.
It's like my backpack.
Yeah, he's like, right. He's like the real Warren Buffett. So anyway, my excuse is this. I grew up poor. I was embarrassed about being poor. And don't tell me if you grew up middle class or upper middle class that you're so evolved because you realize that these things are, you know, that there's more to life than if you grew up poor like me or poorer than me, you want to see what it's like on the other side. And I applaud anybody that achieves getting over on the other side because it's not easy.
But what doesn't Bill say, I've been rich and I've been poor? And or maybe it's Dan Kennedy who says, I've been rich and I've been poor, and I'm pretty sure that being rich is better than being poor.
Yeah, a lot of people say that. Honestly, I don't even think that's true. Like my memories of being a child, apart from the embarrassment of being like in certain social situations at school, but like the way I grew up, the way I ate, the way our family was, is all very positive. You hear this from a lot of people who grew up, movie stars and athletes who talk about they grew up in the hood, you know, mm-hmm. and they say it was a great childhood. And then people say it can't be, you know, it must have been abusive. You were a victim of society. And they were like, well, maybe, but it seemed pretty good to me. And that's how I feel about all that. So so what I'm saying is that this is what I did. I decided to become wealthy and I became wealthy. And a major component of, I think the thing that gave me the ability to do that was a mental thing. It was making everything else secondary.
And so that's what you see in people like Michael Phelps who spend 10 hours in a pool. It's the same.
Right.
They
right.
just want to be the best.
Most successful when you there's a book by Malcolm Gladwell and there's numerous studies that suggest that people
and articles by Mark Ford 10 years before
that's right
Gladwell's book came out
yeah that show you that it's mostly just a question of a focus. But I don't know where we were all going with this, but
I want to ask you something. It's a cheesy question that you can't do anything about, but knowing what you know now, going back to that Dale Carnegie course and say you made the same decision to get rich, how would you have gotten rich differently?
Well, that's what that's the article you read.
Okay.
I said I would have identified that, you know, that you can break your life into four components. Your wealth, your obligation to pay for your life, which is wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Finance your life. Your health. Everybody understands that. And then social and personal. And by social, I mean your family, your husband, your father, your son, you have friends, you have colleagues, you belong to a community, et cetera, et cetera. You may believe you belong to the community of the universe. You define your own social circles and you're a participant in that. And you have to decide, that's a very big part of being a human being. We're social creatures. That's a part of your life that you can't ignore. And the other part is your what I call personal, which is the ideas, the ambitions, the secret hopes for yourself that you've had all along that are part of your motivating personality. I always wanted to be a fireman. I wanted to be a writer. I want to be an athlete. These things linger. They stay with you your whole life. And I think that part of developing yourself as a person that has more peace with himself is to face those things and try to deal with them, either by letting them go or by pursuing them. So that's what I advise people to do now. I say, think about your health, what you want, what health, being in good health means to you. What does wealth mean to you? You know, how wealthy do you have to go? And most of the time, I try to coach people that you don't need nearly as much wealth as you think you need. And you should try to err on the side of setting a goal that you can get to sooner rather than, because if you don't, you'll never, the goal will always be ahead of you.
Like the horizon. You'll never reach
it. Exactly. Never reach it. When I first retired, I had a net worth of over $10 million. And I decided that was not even close to what I needed to be retired. I couldn't possibly live a reasonable lifestyle on $10 million net worth. And so then I went to multiples of that and many multiples. And finally, I did realize that, let's say I'm proud to say that before I hit a net worth of $100 million, I realized I didn't really need to be, and I stopped. And I hadn't destroyed my life, but I hadn't written a book yet. I hadn't done any teaching. I hadn't, teacher, right? Yeah, those three. Nor had I been as good a father as I could have been, a spouse and a friend, this and that. And so now I think that maybe it's possible to stay with this idea of focusing on one thing, but do it in each area. And the reason I think it's possible is because it really is true that to be good socially, if you're concerned about being a spouse or father, excuse me, unless you're the full-time caretaker, it doesn't take all that many hours. I mean, it really is a question of quality over quantity. My problem as a father was that I was never present with my children.
Even when you were with them?
When I was with them, even if I was taking care of them.
And this is before cell phones.
They were running around asking me questions, and I was reading a book and doing bicep curls at the same time. And that's the way it was. And they remember that. And they talk to me about it sometimes. And so I realize now that it wouldn't have taken that many hours away from my wealth building time to accomplish that. And health takes very little time at all. Health is mostly what you're not doing bad things.
You know? Yeah.
It's mostly just, not overeating.
Right.
Eating less takes actually less time. And then, now we know that you can get all the exercise you need in 15 minutes a day, if you're doing high intensity type of exercises, or walking, which is something you can do while you read or while you listen to tapes. So really, it didn't seem that crazy to me to say that. The thing that takes a ton of time, if you're poor to begin with, is becoming wealthy.
Right. So you mentioned something earlier that you try and teach people to set the lower limit. And one of my favorite, pieces that you've ever created is the stuff you have in the Wealth Club about living rich with less money. And what I forget what you said about what income that people need. And then above that, it's all gravy. It's about $250,000.
Well, it was just I had an experience when I was first making $125,000 at the time. And my partner, my boss partner, let me use his accountant. And I'm trying to think of his name. Anyway, he's a very nice guy. And he said to me, well, congratulations. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, you've hit the maximum income that you'll need for the rest of your life. And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's only 125 grand. So today that might be 250 grand.
Okay.
So it's not even close, I can't get a Ferrari. I can't buy a $1 million house, And he said, listen, what you can do now is you can have a house excuse me, you can even have a house with a pool. You can go out to eat at a restaurant once or twice a week. You can take your family on vacation, and you can do all that with the money you're earning now. And that's basically all there is to life, you know. Everything else is just the size of the toys, and they're not going to make you any happier.
Right.
And, you know, I knew he was right.
And this was an old Jewish guy, right?
No, this is a young Jewish guy. His name was Mark. The old Jewish guy was Sid. He was a
Oh, yeah, Sid. That's yeah. Right.
No, Sid was a little bit different. Sid, there was no amount of money that was enough for me. He would yell at me because I would spend money on art.
Wasn't he the guy that taught you negotiation?
He did.
Yeah.
He did. I learned a lot from Sid, but in this respect, he was a little bit different. He became very wealthy himself. But he was definitely of the school of you can't be too rich. Anyway, Ron taught, his name is Ron now. And he said that to me, and I realized he was rich. He was right. And I tried to remember that.
I like that Freudian slip. I realized he was rich.
Yeah, yeah. He was rich in knowledge.
And so you teach today people like, hey, you can sleep like a billionaire just by choosing the right mattress. And you can,
exactly right.
And the car we drove over to, we're in the cigar bar now, and the car you drove over here, you've had for years and years now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was the one I wrote about. It was a 2005 BMW, 12-cylinder. I get almost 9 miles to the gallon.
It's no Prius.
I don't drive it that often, but it's a pleasure. And I don't really, I keep my cars for a long time. It gives me as much pleasure as I can get from any car. Listen, at my age, when you start spending, if I drive a car that's fancier than that car, I look like an ass. I mean, I'm not, why does one spend money on prestige items, have people admire you?
Right.
But the problem is, the only people that admire you are people that you don't want to really be associated with. And anybody that you would want to be hang out with is going to look at, especially if you're my age and you're buying a Lamborghini, you look like an idiot, you know, and they would laugh at you. So
tough to get out of, too.
Yeah, and it's tough to get out of. So, so all that stuff becomes silly. You stop paying attention to that after a while.
Well, on the topic of getting rich, there's something in your book, Ready, Fire, Aim, which everyone should read, is the OSS, the
Optimal Selling Strategy.
Optimal Selling Strategy. So let's dive a little bit deep into actual selling before we go into some productivity stuff.
Sure. Well, the basic idea of that book was that I was trying to explain what I had learned from being involved in really dozens and dozens of different businesses over my career at that point.
And you can't help starting businesses, because we were talking about how you want to help your trainer start a business. It's almost like natural now, right?
I have promised my wife, I promised her this even when I was 50 or 60, I can't remember, that I would never start another business. And if I have started another business since then, I have to say that I would disclaim it if she were here. I do. It's very, once you start a business, it's hard not to have, it's fun starting businesses from scratch and seeing them grow and seeing, especially when you have young partners, seeing them grow and seeing them have successful businesses. But so the book is basically, my idea was that there are four stages that all entrepreneurial businesses go through. Call it, you know, infancy, adolescence, adulthood, and maturity, young adulthood and maturity. And my argument was, in every stage, regardless of the business that you're in, you face the same kind of problems. And in stage one, the main problem is that you have an idea, you're starting a business, but there's a limited amount of cash you have, a limited amount of expertise you have, and a limited amount of patience you have and endurance to push at this business until you give up. So what you have to do in that first period is you have to find a way to start bringing in cash into the business, enough cash to allow your business to run and grow before you run out of your initial capital or before you run out of patience, time, etc. And so that So what you're looking for at that first stage really is, how do I sell my basic product to, how do I bring in new customers at a price using a method that is sustainable, you know, at an allowable acquisition cost. So my concept was, optimal selling strategy means you have to figure out product. What version of the product that I'm selling is going to be the most saleable? How do I package it? What features and benefits does it need to sell? The whole product itself, you have to figure out. How is it going to look? I'm sorry. The second thing you have to figure out is,
it's what the Silicon Valley guys call minimum viable product, I believe.
Minimum viable. Well, the idea of minimum viable product is a smart idea. Many of them don't follow that idea, but it's that, what do you need to have in the product to, the minimum you need to put in the product so that it will be attractive to people?
Yeah.
Buying it. Luckily, I was in the, when you're in the idea world, you don't really have to do that. All you have to figure out is what people want. And then you just tell them that's what they're going to get. And if you get flooded with positive responses and orders, all you have to do then is figure out how the hell you're going to do that.
Yeah.
But at least you've got the money in to do it. But yeah, you have to figure out what the media is. Am I going to sell this on TV? Am I going to sell it by phone? Am I going to sell it through the mail? Am I going to sell it on the internet? And within the internet, what are the channels? Am I going to sell it through Google ads? Am I going to go through ad networks? Am I going to go, you know, am I going to have an email kind of operation, or am I going to try to do, you know, social advertising, blah, 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 blah. All that stuff you've got to figure out. And then you're going to figure out the offer, you know, how much should I charge for it? What kind of bonuses or premiums should I have? What kind of guarantee? All that stuff is critical for selling your business. And you need to figure out, before your time and money runs out, your patience, time and money run out, what that optimal selling strategy is. Everything else is secondary to that. You know, getting your licenses, getting the proper office, finding out, you know, business cards, all the things that people waste time doing is completely unimportant.
You're wasting
time and money on that. And you should basically ignore them. I even tell people, forget about the legal issues. You're so small, you're never going to get in trouble. I mean, and I wouldn't say this to somebody that was, you know, selling seatbelts or selling medicine. But other than that, forget about that stuff. Just go as fast as you can from where you are to figuring out how I can bring in new customers where they're happy to pay the price, and I can scale this kind of advertising. And that's the primary job of that first stage of business. And once you get there, then you've solved the real reason why most businesses fail is because they run out of the time to figure out how to bring in new customers profitably. They're bringing customers unprofitably. They're spending too much. The refunds are too high. All the reasons why businesses don't succeed in that initial stage are because they haven't figured out the optimal selling strategy.
Or they're too scared to sell, probably, because you talk about in the book that you should spend at least 80% of your time selling, you know, whatever the actual percentage is. Most people find so many other things to do with their
time. That is a reason, that is probably the primary reason that people don't spend 80% of their time doing what they should do. But I think it's important to tell people that all those other things you're doing are a waste of your time. Mm-hmm. Don't bother. If you don't need an office, don't open up an office. Don't bother to paint it. Don't bother to worry about people's titles. Start selling your product, even if it means going down to a flea market and start figuring out at the flea market how to package it, how to price it, and so on.
So you wrote that book, what year was that? 2007, right?
That sounds right.
Yeah. And it really impacted a friend of mine, a guy named Michael, who took you out for dinner in New York years and years ago.
I didn't know you knew Michael. Huh?
Yeah, I met him through Matt. And so you know, having written that book over 10 years ago, what would you add to it today if you could add anything to it?
Well, I would add another. I had four stages, but at that time, Agora was $150 million business. Now we're a $1 billion business. So I would talk about how to go from $100 million to $1 billion.
Okay.
But I'm sure maybe
it'd be a small readership, yeah, but what would you say to them?
Well, I would say that there are, of course, there are different ways of doing everything, but I think that what we ended up doing at Agora was the right way to do it, which is we created an environment that was fairly horizontal, as they say today. It was anti-bureaucratic. People, smart people could come in and pretty much do what they want to do. There were no titles to get in their way. There was no lots of protocol and procedure to get in their way. It was very entrepreneurial. But also, we forced the sharing of information. All marketing information at our business was shared across the board. And that came from my own personal experience of believing that the more you share in terms of secrets, your trade secrets, the better and stronger you're going to be. That the whole idea of hiding things from other people was so just wrong. And all the businessmen I know that used to spend time worrying about that, I could just see that they were wasting their time and energy and they were going to go nowhere. And I always had the instinct from the very beginning to tell all my competitors exactly what I was doing, every secret I could find, because I always felt that if I could tell him, then he would start doing it, and then maybe he would do something a little more clever than what I was doing, and then I could borrow from that, mm-hmm. and we could all move forward together. And I believe that that's been true. So I think the reason why we had great diversification, we did not have a business centralized. We let everybody start their own division that wanted to. We funded them. And so long as they were making money and growing, we kept funding them. We only controlled two things. We controlled legal issues so they didn't do anything that was illegal. And we controlled cash flow so they couldn't actually steal money from us. But other than that, it was a very decentralized business. And because we were vertical, because we were sharing information, you had these, and because we hired people that were smart and ambitious, not people that had credentials. I think it's a huge mistake to worry about credentials. Of course, if you're going to run, you need somebody that understands IT to run your IT department, but that's not what's going to grow your business. What's going to grow your business is your marketing. There's basically just three things. People that know how to create products that people will buy. Remember, I didn't say products. I didn't say good products. I said people that know how to create products that people will buy. people that know how to market and sell those products. Marketing and selling are two different things. And then people that know how to manage those other two people so that the company produces profits. Those are the three skill levels that work, that matter in every business. And at Agora, I never believed that you needed any kind of qualifications or experience to be one of those three people. Those are the three people that in our company that make seven-figure annual salaries. And there are many, many of them that make them with us. And we're happy to pay them. They're not the technical people. The people that have great technical expertise tend to make market. They make 100,000, 400,000, whatever the market bears. But the people that make the big money are the people that know how to create profitable growth. And that comes from those three skill sets. Excuse me.
All right, so when you decided to get rich, Mark, we're going to go back a little bit. How did your days change in terms of how you structured them and how you became more productive, or was that already in place? And then how do you become, and you've written so many books, so you've got a lot to teach us about productivity.
Well, I would say that until I started writing, which was much later, I retired first. I became, as I said, I became a decamillionaire when I was 39, retired. And up till then, the only thing I was driving me was the single focus on making money. I didn't have any good, I didn't have any skills in terms of personal productivity. I would say that I was naturally productive because I refused to do anything that I, if you came in and wanted me to talk about something and I could see it wasn't going to make me $100,000, I just stopped talking to you and told you to leave.
So it's all the boundaries. It was like being healthy, just the things not to do.
Right. So, but that's that changed because after, then the next step, when I retired the next time, then I really didn't need any more money. I was way wealthier than I had been. And that's when 10 years later, I was in Rome and I just realized, what am I doing? I'm still like trying to make more and more money and grow these businesses. And I haven't become a writer and I haven't become a teacher and I haven't really, and I'm going on vacations with my family and I'm not even paying attention to what they're saying. I'm still thinking about the business and every spare moment jumping on my computer. And I didn't want to be that person. And so that's when I started writing. The first thing I did after that was I started writing ETR. This was in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And then I naturally, since I was writing about, my, wealth building from my own experience. Everything I did came from my own experience. That was the one promise I made myself, that I wasn't going to read other people's books and regurgitate their knowledge, because most of what I read in books seemed like BS to me. It didn't seem right. It seemed like these were successful guys that had became famous and that they wanted to tell people, they wanted to create a version of themselves that made them seem kindler, gentler,
They wanted to write their own history.
Anybody, any CEO out there who's talking about, sharing and empowering people, they're full of shit as far as I'm concerned. If they're real entrepreneurs, they started from scratch, they should tell you the truth. They didn't care about anything but getting richer. And they were willing to run over people and roll over people. And usually when you read their biographies, not their own highfalutin autobiographies, you'll find out that that's what they were doing. And so, but this is now later. I decide I'm not gonna go trying to make an extra nickel for the rest of my life. And I put becoming wealthier from top priority to a non-existent priority. I wasn't gonna pay attention to it anymore. And that's when I started writing, and that's when I naturally started writing about productivity, because I was writing essentially self-improvement literature. Whether I liked it or not, that's what I was doing. And so productivity is something that everybody wants to know about. Well, what is your average day like? What are you doing? And I didn't have a good answer. So I started thinking about it, hypothesizing, and trying different things myself. And I would say that everything that I've written about those subjects, self-improvement, personal productivity, and so on, came from the experiments that I did from year 2000 to now in training myself to be able to go from being a compulsive moneymaker to somebody that wrote now more than 30 books, somebody that has written 5,000 poems, that has produced 3 movies, written numerous scripts, to all the other things that I've done since then that had nothing to do with money. Some of them actually were costly. My movies were enormously costly. came from learning how to discipline myself and learning productivity techniques.
So when you were younger, it was just like running through a wall, and you also had youthful energy, I suppose.
Too, youthful energy, running through a wall. And certain things were instinctive. Like, since I was only thinking about money, if there were email at the time, I'm sure I wouldn't have been bothering with it because I would have instinctively known it was a waste of my time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was only later that when I was actually writing about it, I remember nobody was nobody was saying that email is evil in 2000 except me.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only one saying that. Now everybody's saying that. Nobody was saying that you have to spend the first hour of your day doing the thing that's going to change your life in the long term. I'm telling you, if I'm wrong, somebody should send me something from 2000 where somebody was saying it. But the reason I was writing those things was because I felt like such a contrarian, because I was reading the opposite kind of advice. Entrepreneurial advice in entrepreneurial magazines about, well, the first thing you got to do is, you know, get registered, make sure you're not violating any laws, fill out these forms, get a nice office, hire them. It's all crazy stuff. And the same was true of all the, well, I was reading about management, personal productivity, efficiency. It was all seemed like crap. And so I experimented and I came up with all these ideas. And the reason I find it hard right now is that everybody has discovered those things. I think because they're basically true.
Mm-hmm.
If you think long, you know, it doesn't take you long to figure out that email is everybody else trying to get you to do their work. Not the other way around. So, you know, people found out, and now people write about it. And now when I sit down to write, it's still just as true as ever. And when I have a bad day in terms of productivity, it's because I open up that damn email and I just say, oh, I'm so good now. I can do this and it won't hurt me. Sure. And an hour and a half later, I'm completely drained. I have no more motivation. I just want to go into bed and take two Advil and fall asleep because I've been reading this horrible email all morning. So these are all very true things, but they're very exciting at the time. And so I developed all these, I think, very helpful and useful things that allowed me to do everything I did, but I don't think they're especially new to anybody. Although I think that you've taken it one step further with your perfect day formula. I think that I was looking at how you took those ideas and you refined them a little bit better, and how you separate the morning from the afternoon and so on. I think those are helpful, and I try to put them into my own thinking when I'm aiming to have a productive day.
Very good. And so I like how you had that epiphany in Rome, and I want to switch gears a little bit to the vacations, and, you know, you travel the world and tour the world. And I like to say that you were Tim Ferriss before there was a Tim Ferriss, because you're a black belt in jiu-jitsu. You still, you know, you're still kicking people's butts, and you're a multi-millionaire. So how did you, yeah, and you,
I'm glad you said that about Tim Ferriss, because I remember when I had 900,000 readers before Tim Ferriss had, he was just beginning, and somebody wanted me to interview him, and I was like, "Who's that guy? He's nobody." That's what happens when you take yourself too seriously. But I think actually he does study jiu-jitsu. I don't think he's a black belt yet. But yeah, I do feel a little competitive when I don't know why. He's way younger than me, and he's what he does is terrific. But I think that for some people. If I were a child today, I would be diagnosed as having attention deficit disorder. And so, and I also have a kind of a compulsive need to get things done. So those two mental deficiencies have combined to allow me to become a person that has done a lot of different things in my life. So, but I have no doubt that it's better. You see, I've done a lot of different things, and I've done them well, but I've never been really, really great, you know?
Just really great, not really, really great.
Right, I've been good. I've been kind of great. I like when people say it's great, but I know that the truth is that if you have as many interests as I do, you know, you're just – to be Michael Jordan, to be Mozart, you just have to be –
relentless. Have you read that
relentless.
Book?
Relentless. You have to narrow your focus. And I mean, one of the differences between me and my partner at Agora is that I was not willing to, all he did, he put all his cookies in one cookie jar, I guess. What is the term?
All the eggs in one basket.
All the eggs in one basket.
I like cookies in a cookie jar better, way better.
And his cookie jar is way bigger than mine now.
He doesn't even care.
He doesn't care.
He's like your dad.
Right. So,
Well, what do you plan on doing with the next 40 years of your life?
Yeah, 40. You know, it's funny. You get to my age and you can't help it. You know, it does really, time really does speed up. And, you know, I think about death all the time now. It sounds very morose, but I do. I keep thinking, you know, I bought that car in 2005. It's 2018. That is 13 years. 13 years from now, I could be, I'm going to be 80. I could be dead. I mean, if I died at 80, everybody said, well, you had a nice long life. But I don't want to die. I don't want to die at all. I still have lots of stuff I want to do.
Like what?
Well, I have this project that you just saw, my palm tree botanical garden. I want to make that into a really good, not the greatest in the world, but a really good palm tree botanical garden.
Okay.
I still have
the – I think it's really great.
No, thank you.
But I don't know.
You're so wise. You're probably smarter than I am in that regard. I still want to make another movie, but the only chance I have of that is if the movie I just made, if I could sell it and make the money back that I invested, then I'm allowed to. My wife said I can make another one. But you know, my real ambitions are just to spend more time with my family and friends, to have a third act where I'm more slowed down. I'm not building businesses. I don't want to build any businesses. And I don't really want to write anymore, except maybe fiction, because, as I said, I don't feel like I have anything to contribute anymore. I don't have any...
contrarian thoughts?
Yeah, the contrarian... You know, everybody... the internet is exploded with people sharing their experiences. And I felt that I was saying radical things back then, and people were shocked when I would say things like that. But now I don't think that's so true anymore. You know, even as far back as when James Altucher interviewed me a few years ago, and he was all on the, you know, you can never make money as an employee. And that was like one of the last contrarian statements. I was telling you completely wrong. I made tens of millions of dollars as an employee. You can get super rich as an employee. And that was the last time that I remember saying a contrarian thing to a very bright person and seeing him, you know, like be challenged by the idea. This is shows you who he is. 6 months later, he had written a book about how to become a millionaire as an employee.
There you go. Well, right. Everybody learns it from you.
But he had made a damn book about it. I mean...
All right. So having said all that, is there one thing that you would say to a younger Mark Ford if you could?
How young of a Mark Ford?
I'll let you choose. It could be the 39-year-old decamillionaire. Right. Could be the 21-year-old just going off to Africa.
Well, I think the main thing is...
or maybe that one that was in the Dale Carnegie course.
Yeah, I would go back to... I would say don't do what I did. I mean, if you really believe that getting rich is the most important thing, the only thing that really matters, then go ahead and do what I did then, and you will get rich. Unless there's something wrong with you, it'll be the easiest way to get rich. But if you want to try to get rich without possibly ruining every other aspect of your life, then I think that you should go back to the advice that you had read, which was just pick one health goal, one social goal. So, for example, getting rich is going to take most of your time, for sure. It's going to take 60 or 80 hours a week. It's not going to take 40 hours a week. It's impossible. There's no four-hour work week. I mean, we all know that. Until later on, now I can have a four-hour work week. Fine. Money's still coming in. Everything's great. But when
you spend 4 hours a week writing signing your name on checks.
But you can't do that when you're starting out. That takes the most amount of time. If getting wealthy, if you're young and getting wealthy is something you want to do, expect to work at least 60 hours a week doing that. But also don't make it your only priority, but do understand that it has to be your primary goal. In other words, that you are going to have to make sacrifices in the other areas. So, for example, in health, I don't think you can say that you want to make as your goal in health to to be able to run a 5-minute mile, because that takes too many hours of your time, or to win a black belt tournament. That takes a 25 hours a week to accomplish. I think your health goal should be that you have a normal cardiac reading by the time you don't weigh more than 400. You have to pick a goal for your health that's congruent with the demands of a well. Likewise, if you have a personal goal, don't say you're going to publish a novel too this year. You're not. But maybe you can take a goal where you tell yourself you're going to write, good or bad, 50 words or 100 words a day. Mm-hmm. But it has to be good or bad. Mm-hmm. Don't try to give yourself – this is actually something radical, something that your people haven't heard about productivity that I can tell you. Nobody's saying now, but they will. What everybody says about picking goals, and I think I might have even said it once early on, is that to make your goals successful, they have to be specific. Mm-hmm. You have to identify a specific goal at a specific time. This is a huge mistake. Your major goals should never be specific and dated. They need to be broad. And it would take me a half hour to explain, but I just want to let you and your readers know. It's a giant mistake. Your shorter term objectives need to be more and more specific, down to your daily objectives, which are super specific and super time oriented. But your overall goals have to be broad and have to be large, because the main thing is to accomplish them. And you don't even know when you're setting goals what you actually really want. You don't know what being rich really means, how many millions of dollars that is. And you have no idea how long it's going to take you. You don't know if you want to become a successful playwright, what that even means. Does it mean write one great play that nobody ever forgets, or writing 10 a year? So anyway, there's a contrary thought that I have that is new. So I've said it and it's gone. So anyway, the point is, I do think that you can create and have an abundance of wealth by making it a primary goal. But you should identify other goals in those areas. Socially, what do you want to accomplish? You know, you can be a good father and a good spouse. Yeah, well, it depends. Maybe younger people can't, because the expectations are. But my generation, you could do that in 2.5 hours a day, all day long, very easily. You could do it in an hour a day. If you're super attentive and you're paying attention, you're right there with them, that's more than most people do. So I think that's what I would say. I would say don't abandon other things, but just recognize that the most amount of hours is going to go into your wealth-building goal, and your other goals should be more realistic during the time that wealth is your primary time consumer.
Well, thanks, Mark. I guess I'm off to write a book about goal setting now. All right. With that contrarian piece.
Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah.
Well, I really, really appreciate it. This was probably the most stimulating conversation I've had in a long time, and our listeners are really going to appreciate it. So thank you for telling your story.
It's a pleasure, as always, Greg. Thanks for taking over Early to Rise. It couldn't be in better hands.
Oh, well, thank you.
Wow, what an epic interview. Now, before our chat, I thought I knew everything about Mark's journey, but I mean, on this show, I learned over a dozen lessons, and I hope you did too. Mark and I would love to hear what you think about today's show and how you plan to change your goal setting so that you get rich while focusing on what matters. And maybe now you'll be able to answer that question. What advice would you give to your younger self? So keep me posted, and please email me at support@earlytorise.com or send me a message on Instagram.com/realcraigvalentine or at twitter.com/craigvalentine. Thanks for listening to Early to Rise Radio. Please head over to iTunes and rate today's show, give us 5 stars, and share it with your friends. Now go and refine your goals so that you become more productive and successful in life. And after that, please visit Mark Ford's new website at markford.net, where he publishes brand new articles all the time.